For March Madness, Sports Illustrated has a special show, Tourney Talk, hosted by Ted Keith and David Gardner. Each morning during the NCAA tournament, you'll find a recap of the previous day's highlights and a preview of what's to come. That's Tourney Talk with Ted Keith and David Gardner. Find it on iTunes, Stitcher, or si.com/podcasts.
I got an email out of the blue from Bill Simmons, and I thought it was a joke. I honestly thought someone had made a fake email address to impersonate Bill Simmons. And it just, I think the email just basically said, we'd love to talk to you. We'd love to talk to you about joining us at some point. I had a place where I was confident it was going to last. I was confident my career was going to be okay. I liked my boss. I liked my colleagues. And when you get into a situation like that, if you're generally kind of an insecure, anxious personality, you don't want that taken away. And then it gets taken away and your whole world is kind of upside down. Like, what's going to happen to me? What's going to happen to the site? What's going to happen to my career? Who do I work for now? It was all of those kind of emotions. Yeah, I mean, it was... You felt like you were part of something, and I still feel like I'm part of something. So it was sad, but I mean, heartbreaking is like, this is the way of the world.
Welcome to the Sports Illustrated Media Podcast, where each week we interview a member of the sports media. My name is Richard Deitch. My producer is Alan Kim. And this week, our guest is the ESPN senior writer, Zach Lowe, who specializes in the NBA. Prior to working for ESPN specifically, Zach was a writer for Grantland, as well as Sports Illustrated and SI.com. His journalism roots go back to covering crime at the Stanford Advocate. Zach also worked at The American Lawyer. He's a native of Connecticut. I believe we share the same graduate school alma mater, Columbia University Graduate School of Journalism. And Zach Lowe is now the second person to tape a Sports Illustrated Media podcast in studio. The great Paul Heyman, of course, was first. I don't think Zach will be going into professional wrestling, but he is here in beautiful downtown Manhattan. Zach Lowe, finally, taking a long time. Welcome to the Sports Illustrated Media Podcast.
If it makes you feel any better, I have friends that don't see me during the NBA season, so it is what it is. But yeah, Paul Heyman, you can't get people to come in here, and New York's the media capital of the world. A lot of your guests.
I kind of feel like it's. I like I like actually them not being here. I feel like it sets up more intimacy and it's like a different kind of podcast.
All right, we'll see how it goes.
All right, first of all, Zach, before we get to your interesting career, let's talk about the fact that you have revealed to Alan Kim and myself that The Ringer rented a beach house prior to launch. And so essentially, was it like the real world where they would have all these people together in a house coming up with creative ideas, and maybe Simmons occasionally takes the Ferrari and hangs out and goes there? I'm fascinated by this.
I'm not sure Bill had a Ferrari. My understanding, now they have office space because you just saw yesterday they announced the hirings of 9,000 people.
Good hires.
I think that the first few people that went out there in transitional phase before they got housing, someone rented a large house and they lived there. But I believe that's over.
Was it on the beach or was it somewhere downtown? Do you know?
No clue.
At some point, we're going to talk about your sort of career arc and career path. I mean, do you want me to get the question out of the way about your interest in The Ringer right now or no? Or should we save that for later?
You can do it whenever you want,
Richard. All right, we'll save that for later. First off, one of the things that I think people are really interested about you is how you determine what is interesting content. And I'm interested in that, too. When you have so much to choose from and it's such an amazing sport, so what... As a sort of a philosophical question, how do you determine what's interesting NBA content?
I mean, a lot of the basics comes from just watching a lot of basketball, right? Like, so you have to know what your sweet spot is. So, like, I'm not going to get like the day to day covering the team quotes because the beat writers are going to get that. I'm not going to get the day to day locker room drama because the beat writers are going to get that. So a lot of it is like I watch a lot of basketball and I see stuff that's interesting to me, and if I haven't read a good story on it yet, because I read a lot, obviously, maybe I'll write that story. So a lot of it just comes down from stuff that I see on film and sort of going from there. And a lot of times, as you know, it's not the question that you initially asked that ends up being the interesting one. It's the follow-up question, six questions down the line. So it's really – it's it's kind of it's that. And then it's, you know, now I've developed enough sources that I hear stuff that maybe isn't a scoop, but is going to lead me down a path that maybe there's a trend that no one has really written about yet.
Zach, as an overall question, why is the NBA interesting? You could be covering the NFL. You could be covering crime somewhere. But this is the content you've chosen to marinate in. So what is interesting about the league?
Well, it chose me. I didn't choose the NBA. I mean, I grew up a huge NBA fan. NBA and Major League Baseball were the sports that I followed the most. How I got into covering the NBA is a different random story. But I mean, the NBA is interesting to me for many, many reasons. I mean, the fan base skews young. It's a fast game that is appealing to watch. The on-court strategy has evolved in all sorts of interesting ways over the last 10 to 15 years that has sort of culminated in Steph Curry, who is a phenomenon. And it has a social media playfulness to it that a lot of leagues that take themselves too seriously don't have.
That's a really good point. And I think the contrast with the NFL, which is the most popular sport in this country, and the NBA, when it comes to social media, trying to attract millennials, it's pretty stark. It's interesting, actually. I think whether you give Adam Silver credit or David Stern or whoever, their embracing of social media in relationship to people under 25 is unbelievable for a global league.
Yeah, and it's fans that age and younger watch the game in a different way than fans our age do, and right. The NBA was early to understand that and embrace it. And look, they do things like, look, I mean, we all steal video content from them every day.
Right.
And they've just decided it as an organization. They don't care because they think it's good for the game and good for their league.
Which it is. People always associate you with video, GIFs, tape, however you want to sort of frame it. On a given week, how many games are you watching? Even if it's not from beginning to end, roughly what are you consuming in a given week?
My general baseline is I watch two games a night from beginning to end, beginning to garbage time. because I just find for me, I am not a channel flipper. I am not a four games at once on three different TVs kind of guy. My brain doesn't process information that way. My brain processes information. I'm going to sit down. I'm going to close my laptop. I'm going to get out a notebook, and I'm going to watch a game 48 minutes. Now, I watch it on DVR, so I save time. But I'm going to watch it start to finish so I get a sense of – and you do that enough times with the same team, you get a sense of their rhythms, their rotations, and you notice right away, okay, that substitution pattern is different. That strategy is different. The rhythm of their team this night is different. So that's my baseline, and that way you end up watching every team a lot. Like I think it works out to like 25 or 30 times a year, 20 to 25 times a year. And then maybe if there's a game that's close in the last 2 minutes, I'll flip over to watch that in real time or one or two of those kind of games.
How do you choose the games? Do you choose a specific team for that night? Do you go by whatever you have league pass, so I don't think you're just choosing the national game. Is there a pattern to what you want to watch that night?
I wish there were some like algorithm or like Zach Lowe's DVR wheel that you would spin around. A lot of fans think that the media is biased towards, you know, the big teams. Like,
right.
I try to watch every team in equal amount. So if I haven't watched the Pistons in the last three games, it's tonight's a Pistons night. Now, that said, every time one of the super teams plays each other, you have to watch that game. Spurs Thunder, you have to watch.
Right.
Warriors Spurs, you have to watch. So you end up watching those teams a little bit more because when they play each other, you have to watch it. But I watch the Sixers a lot. It's sad. My life is sad, Richard. That's what people don't understand. When you're like, oh, man, I got to watch the Kings again tonight. Like, that's sad.
And you have a new baby, right? So you have to navigate fatherhood with the Sixers, which is tricky.
That is you have two new babies.
That's true.
A little bit. I believe yours are a little bit older than mine.
A little bit older, yeah.
My daughter just turned one a few weeks ago. Yeah, time management is now the single biggest priority in my life.
No doubt. No doubt about that. As someone who watches basketball around the NBA, which is a rare person, have you gotten any kind of, I don't know if trend is the right word, but I'll ask it direct. How would you evaluate the quality of local NBA broadcasting around the country? You don't have to, you don't have to nail anybody.
You're trying to get me here.
No. But curious, because I always find that when I spin around NBA League Pass, you know, it goes from a very professional down the middle broadcast to some guys who are like so over the top homers. It's incredible.
That's exactly correct. Look, even the over the top homers, right? I think it's important to remember.
Can be funny. Right.
They're funny and they're really good broadcasters, right? Like they're trained. They know how to do it. They know how to talk. Some of them know how to analyze the game quite well. They're just, for whatever reason, and sometimes not entirely of their own volition, broadcasting the game in a way that the market dictates for whatever reason. The homer ones, I actually think they're damaging to the NBA,
That's
truthfully.
That's interesting. Okay.
Because they foster this idea that the refs are out to get us and the refs are crooked and blah, blah, blah. And I just, like, that filters down to fans who, like, anytime there's a controversial call in the finals, like, half of the commentary is about who the refs are out to get. And I think the homer announcers are part of that.
That's interesting because
I know Adam wants to not have homer announcers. Like, I think that's an issue. That's an issue he's raised.
Let's sort of examine that. I would agree with Adam Silver. To me, I like a middle of the road broadcast. But how do you prevent teams from putting on their greatest stars in this broadcast capacity, where their owner probably wants them to cheer and to be a homer? You know, I agree with Adam Silver. But how do you convince Jim Dolan not to have
The Knicks broadcast is great. They're not homers.
It's
at
not
all.
A great example.
We are spoiled here in New
York.
Yeah,
I agree. It's not a great example. But, you know, how do you convince an owner who essentially sees the role of broadcaster as marketing to see it in a different way?
Well, I'll give you the example. Like, so I complained about the Spurs broadcast a lot because Sean Elliott is me.
I don't hear that enough. That's interesting.
And although I think Sean is actually kind of good natured about it, there's not a negativity. Right. The mix of homerness and negativity is when you get the most toxic brew. And the Spurs will tell you, or the Spurs TV people will tell you, for whatever metrics they've done, like, that's what the fans want.
Exactly.
So I don't know that you really can tell them.
That's a good question. You know, I'm sure people in Boston love Tommy Heinsohn, and I don't think he's mean-spirited. I think he's more funny.
Exactly.
But he is a homer, you know, of the highest.
He walked!
Order. Yeah. Like, to me, that's funny, homer, as compared to, I think it would be grating if you started listening to somebody who every night was saying the refs are against us, and every night, like, you know, there's a conspiracy against T-Max, which is not the case. I wrote a column not too long ago. And when you were coming in, I wanted to just sort of get your take on this. I think at a certain point this year, every Warriors game should have been on national television. Like, when we were 39, 38 games in. What do you think of that idea? Whether ESPN, NBA TV, or Turner, some kind of form or fashion.
Well, see, what you're really saying is it should be on NBA TV, right?
Yeah, because the games that are not on the national.
Those other networks can't really. I guess they could to some degree. But there are some nights where TNT is going to be showing something actually good.
Right.
It drives me nuts that NBA TV has non-game content on when they could easily have game content on a light night of NBA action. So, like, and I think that's part of the national TV deal is, like, on Thursday nights, there can't be a competitive game.
Right. You get exclusivity if you're Turner. Right.
But it just drives me nuts because they're just showing these endless highlight shows, and they're okay, but, like, there's games. Show me a game.
So you're saying less Rick Kamla, more Steph Curry.
I like Rick Kamla. I've partied with Rick Kamla. Kamla's a good dude. I don't want less Rick Kamla. I just, like, do I need 7 hours of studio show when, like, I could have 5 hours of that in a game?
Alan Kim, that is the first I've partied with Rick Kamla drop or reference on this podcast. So that's exciting.
Partied is strong. I've been at parties with Rick Kamla.
That's an exciting thing. All right. The Marc Gasol All-Stars. How long have you done that for?
I think this was the fourth one.
Fourth year. That is an example of you really using video and clips to sort of amplify your pros. I don't know what the right phrasing of this is, because I don't want it to sort of come off as because I'm really impressed by it. To me, that's like a stylistic thing you do in terms of you really use and incorporate video well to amplify what you are writing around that. I don't know if you are the person who sort of first did that in the NBA.
I was not.
Okay, so you were not. But I think clearly you're one of the most prominent people who does this. What's the sort of the genesis behind that? Why did you think that kind of format online would really bring viewers in, where you not only just write something, but you sort of diagram it and point it out?
I think it's two things. The first one, the long view one, is so I got into NBA writing kind of sideways, right? I had no access. I had no sources. I had no press credentials. And so I had to think about what's going to make my writing worth reading. What can I do to differentiate myself? And that was get into the X's and O's, because not a lot of people have the space or the time to do that, and they're tricky to learn and all of that. So that's sort of how I got interested in it. And then when I started to have access to video and stuff, it's kind of like when you describe a play, even a simple play, it's like a lot of jargon and words. And it's like when you can just show it and like, oh, that's what it means when they hedge a pick, or that's what it means when someone slips a screen. Like, that just works better.
Early on in your NBA writing, was there somebody, whether it was a coach, an assistant coach, a writer, who really educated you on the nomenclature of the sport?
Not any one person. I mean, there were definitely coaches. It's lots and lots of people, to be honest. There's not any one person. I mean, there were definitely people who would come to me at games in wherever I was and say, hey, you know, and I read your column and you got 85% of it right, but like this one thing you wrote about why we do X, Y, and Z on the pick and roll, you actually missed this one angle. Like, oh, okay, yeah, that's how you learn.
Interesting.
That's how you learn.
The in doing a little research, tell me if I'm wrong about this. No, this isn't tough. Tell me if I'm wrong about this. The arc here, you were working for the Stanford Advocate. You're covering crime, and I'll get to that in a little bit.
With Sports Illustrated's Allie Fenwick.
With Sports Illustrated's Allie Fenwick, one of the great people here. You started doing some freelancing for the Wall Street Journal.
That comes later.
Okay, what I want to do is, what is the bridge between you as a crime reporter at the Stanford Advocate to you getting your foot in the door for NBA writing?
I left the Stanford Advocate to go to work for a magazine called American Lawyer, which covers law firms and business.
Well, a pretty well-respected one.
Yeah. I mean, just for casual listeners who may not know, non-media people. It was a Stephen Brill publication in the day. And I was there. I just really wanted to be in New York, and the newspaper in Stanford, the Tribune Company, had gone bankrupt, and it was just bad times. So I got a good job there. I helped start their blog. And I was sort of like, I knew in my heart of hearts that I didn't want to write about law firm partners switching law firms and the financial collapse and all that. It was interesting, but it wasn't my thing. And I just started kind of working my connections. And one of my connections led me to Sam Walker, who was the sports editor of the Wall Street Journal, I believe still is.
Yep.
And he was kind enough to have coffee with me. This was probably in 2009. And just shooting the breeze, said, you know, I mean, we don't have a lot of guys who are really well-versed in the NBA. So if you wanted to freelance for us, that may be an avenue in for you, because for whatever reason, we need more of that. And LeBron was about to become a free agent. He understood that was a big deal. And so I started pitching them ideas. I started live blogging for them. And that was really helpful. It was really generous of them, because I had no experience at the time covering sports, really.
Did that lead to, or were you doing at the same time doing some kind of Celtics blog?
I don't know what led to what. I actually started my own blog, which I've taken down because it's so bad.
Bring that back. I want to read
for
that.
All the ideas that the Wall Street Journal correctly rejected. I started my own blog, and naturally, I grew up a Celtics fan, so naturally, I was writing 50% of it about the Celtics. And at that time, Henry Abbott was starting a True Hoop network at ESPN, and he and Kevin Arnovitz somehow landed. Actually, they didn't somehow land on me. They landed on me because I emailed everyone any piece of content, any scrap of content I had for a link. And they said, hey, you might be an okay fit for this. So that's how that came about. So all those things are kind of happening at once.
That's interesting. It's also a very good lesson then, to get your stuff in front of the right people would be the lesson Zach gives you there. So what you're freelancing at the Wall Street Journal. What were you doing for True Hoop in 2009? Were you freelancing for them, doing different things?
Yeah, just literally, they had their goal was, we want a blog for each team.
Okay.
That we're going to have a drop-down menu on ESPN.com's True Hoop blog, and you can get to them. And I think they actually did have a blog for each team for a decent amount of time. And you're going to help write the Celtics one. So literally, it was all Celtics coverage, basically.
So you're doing these two things, and you're getting some inroads in the NBA. Is the next big thing the SI thing or something else? So how did Sports Illustrated find you? I don't even know the story.
Yeah, this is a convergence of worlds thing. So I'm doing this, and by the way, I always tell people, like, if you want to really make it in this business, like, you're gonna have to have 2 or 3 years in your life where you just work 18 hours a day. There's just no way around it. So that's what I did for 2+ years. I had two jobs basically, and one of those jobs, I was working at American Lawyer, and one of my best sources was a legal recruiter who read my basketball stuff, because he, like, once I alerted him to it,
right,
he read it. We were having coffee one day. And he said, you know, one of my buddies works at Sports Illustrated. Would you ever want an intro? And I don't even know who that buddy was. I don't think it was Brad Weinstein, who ended up being the editor who hired me.
Right.
But it was somebody who connected me with Brad. And this was right ahead of LeBron's free agency. And Brad said, you know, we're looking to start a daily NBA blog. We don't have one. Would you have any interest in that? And I tried to contain my excitement. So of course I would. And then the next thing he said was, do you know anything about any other team but the Celtics? I said, yeah, I watch every team as much as I can. And I'm well-versed in who, you know, Tyreke Evans is and blah, blah, blah. And they took a shot on me. Again, a lot of people took shots.
And that was the Point Forward blog. Is that what that was called back
then? The Point Forward, yeah, which does not exist anymore.
Does not. All right, we should mention two things here. One, Brad Weinstein now works for the NBA. Absolutely, if not my favorite colleague ever, he's in the Mount Rushmore. He's a great editor, a phenomenal line editor, and just someone so dedicated his job. So the NBA got a good one. If I had millions of dollars and I had to money whip some people back, Brad would be first. I would try to get Mallory Rubin back from Simmons' mansion, and then a couple of others.
Brad is
a great guy. So we'll just, and he probably won't be happy that we reference him here, but I don't really care. All right, so you're at Sports Illustrated, and I imagine now that you're at a place with a reputation. Is this where you can start making some sources around the league and you start going to games more and stuff like that?
It's where I started to get credentials to the Knicks and the Nets, or I guess not the Nets weren't in Brooklyn then, so really just the Knicks. And I wanted to do that more because it's the only way to really meet people. And so it was hard to do that because when I first got that job, I was posting 2, 3, 4 times a day.
I remember. Yeah.
And you just can't really get out of the house. And so I would I would ask Brad, and Brad was great about finding time to do it. I would say, look, let me go to Philly for this Sixers homestand and just be there, maybe write one thing a day instead of 3 things a day. And Brad was great about letting that happen. He sent me to All-Star and let me network at All-Star as much as I could. And it just, yeah, it was just, you know, a lot of drinks with people, dinners with people, lunches with people. But yeah, at SI, finally I could do that.
Do you consider the SI hire or the Grantland hire sort of when your career really changed, the trajectory of your career changed? Which is it? Now, you're obviously not getting to Grantland without being at SI.
Right.
But Grantland was a different kind of rocket ship than SI.
It's funny to think about that in retrospect, though, because, like, SI is SI. You know what I mean? Like, SI should be the rocket ship. I think Grantland just had this nexus of it was new, it was hip, it was Bill, it was a thing everyone was curious about. But truthfully, I think – so that definitely was another level. But, like, SI, to me, is a huge deal, always was a huge deal. And, like, I don't get anywhere without that first hire, nowhere.
Right. So how does – now that we can sort of talk about this now because it happened a couple of we're years in the past. So how does Bill Simmons approach you? Or maybe it's not Bill Simmons or his emissaries. How did Grantland approach you about that job?
I got an email out of the blue one day. We'll never forget where I was. I was at my sister-in-law's house in Philadelphia, Westchester, Pennsylvania.
Yeah.
I got an email out of the blue from Bill Simmons, and I thought it was a joke. I honestly thought someone had made a fake email address to impersonate Bill Simmons. And I think the email just basically said, we'd love to talk to you. We'd love to talk to you about joining us at some point.
Okay, so that happens. You figure out at a certain point this is real. Do you fly out to Los Angeles? Does Bill come to New York? How does it work? What's the process, the romancing process? How does that happen?
The romancing process. I don't know how much detail I really want to get into on this.
Right,
The romancing process is I turn them down.
At a certain point, you must have met with either him and or somebody else. No.
I never
it was all
met,
over the phone?
I never met Bill before I worked at Grantland.
Wow.
Ever. The person I met – And Bill had me at – because it was I'm naturally an anxious, fretful person, right?
Right.
So, like, I look at Grantland back then. You have to remember, I look at Grantland as, like, who knows if this is going to make it.
Right.
Like, an SI is SI.
But it does have ESPN, and it's part of its, you know, outreach.
I actually had lunch with John Walsh.
That was the emissary
where Bill said, if you want to sit down with someone who can assuage your fears, this is the guy. So John Walsh and I had lunch one day.
So John Walsh is trying to pull for you. He's meeting with Tommy Craigs. He was one of the guys who was out there fronting for Bill. Okay. At a certain point then, and I remember, you know, I watched online the Grantland celebration in New York, or the post celebration. And you told the story of how you weren't sure if you should go to Grantland, and your wife basically was like, stop being a fraidy cat. This is great for you and go. So was it ultimately in the end that she convinced you that you got to take this leap?
She helped. They always say that you should marry someone who offsets your weaknesses, right?
So definitely.
Like, my whole life, she's done that, not just with Grantland, but like, you know, I remember when I had a gap between jobs, not that I was unemployed, but I had time before starting a new job. And she was like, why don't you just go to somewhere in Central America by yourself? And I said, I don't know if I can do that. And then she said, stop being such a wimp. Here's a plane ticket to Guatemala. It costs $200. Just buy it and go.
Right.
And it was that. And it was, you know, the story I told it. It was just the fact that I was tired and burned out from writing 2, 3, 4 times a day, and I didn't see an avenue at SI to not do that.
Had SI given you something similar to what Grantland did, you think you would have stayed here? You might have still gone to Grantland anyway.
I might have still gone to Grantland anyway because of the hip new factor, but if for sure, and SI, yeah, for sure, yeah. I loved SI. I love SI. I still get SI.
We appreciate that.
And to work there was a huge deal for me.
Eventually you make the decision, you're working for Grantland, you can stay back here east, they don't make you go out to Los Angeles, right?
Nope.
Okay. And what was there, whether it was Bill or Daniel Fearman, I'm not even sure who your immediate bosses would have been, did they give you like a charter to say, Zach, here's what we want you to do, and if so, what was that?
I think, I don't want to speak out of school, but I think they felt they needed a day-to-day NBA guy. That in year one of the site, they tried to sort of, everyone was chipping in. And they're all so goddamn good that you can make it work that way.
Right.
But I think they felt like, we need one guy who people know when there's a trade, this is the guy that's going to write. When someone breaks his leg, this is the guy that's going to write. That just can be, that doesn't have his hands in, because all those guys are writing about the NBA. They got their hands in running the site in other sports and blah, blah, blah. And I think that was – I don't think there was ever like, here are your expectations per week. I just think it was however many times you write per week, that's going to be you. You're going to be the guy.
How much of the fact that Simmons loving the NBA was a draw to you versus maybe the fact that he loves the NBA so much is intimidating because you got to write up against him, a guy who's got, at that time, whatever, 500,000 people reading him all the time? If not more.
I did think about it, not just Bill. Bill exists in his own universe, right? You know you never can compete with Bill. You're never going to compete with Bill.
Right.
It's sort of like—
Not in terms of metrics or anything.
No, and just in terms of like a Bill column almost exists separately from Grantland. It's its own separate thing. I did think about, we have so many people that are writing about the NBA. Well, I kind of get lost in that jumble. Like we just look at all the people that wrote about the NBA there.
Right.
But no, I didn't. None of that really worried me too much. I realized, because my thought was, if I do get lost in that jumble, it's a great jumble. I don't care.
At what point in your Grantland tenure did you kind of know that, all right, we have something here? I don't know exactly what it is. And I'm not even sure if, you know, we're the biggest site on the web. There's the Yahoos and the ESPNs are always going to get more. But at what point did you know, like, we're connecting with a group of people that's become really personal to that group of people?
Not that far in, honestly. Like, it was a cool – I mean, everyone likes Bill. Like, Bill is so popular that I think by association, the thing was going to be popular. But it was the combination of pop culture and sports, I think, resonated with people. You know, I'd go to games, and people would say, we love Grantland, you know, and it wasn't that far in. It wasn't – because I got in – I think the site was like a year and a half in operating when I got in. So it wasn't like I was in from the ground floor. So it wasn't that far. But definitely when what happened with Bill happened with Bill, there was definitely a sense of if this goes the way it looks like it's going to go, it's going to be a shame because I feel like we're rolling now.
We'll get to that in a second.
I'm glad.
Something that's it's a long process. It's romantic. The interesting thing, though, about you and Grantland is that you did your work on the East Coast, their West Coast base in terms of their main group. So I don't know if odd is the right word, but how did you feel about you're part of this group. It's making great inroads with people. They love it, but you're not walking in the office every day. So you're almost like this own satellite, you know, country that exists away from the base of the operations. Was that weird, or did you long to be part of that group so you can connect the faces to the bylines that you saw, or as an independent contractor, that's sort of the life you lead and you're nice, you're cool in your own little NBA Universe.
Was I don't even know if I was an independent contractor.
Or whatever, you know what I'm saying. Like, that's my phrase, but like, you know, there was an LA group. And yeah. They went out and they hung out and they got really close together. You were a very integral part of that site, but you're sort of your own universe in New York and Philly.
We had Grantland East. We had Andy Greenwald and me and Rembert Brown and Jason Concepcion and Andrew Sharp.
Did you guys go to an office like every day?
No. Okay. But we would see each other around and you knew at the very least there was a lot of non-LA people. And I worked at SI for 2 years and I worked from home. I was probably in the office four times total.
Right. I don't think I've ever seen you in the office.
Yeah, I was used to it.
Let's talk about your podcast for a second as we spin on this. My guess is that you are someone who probably never thought you'd be doing a podcast, and now you're doing it. You clearly love it. So why do you love it?
Not only did I not think I would ever have a podcast, I initially said no to having one and fought for a long time not to have one. I really have grown to love it. I think it's part. So my mistake was I don't listen to a lot of podcasts. I listen to more now because I feel like I need to learn, and there are so many great ones that have great NBA guests. And I just thought, well, probably not that many people listen to podcasts. A lot of people.
Certainly yours.
I don't know about that, but a lot of people listen to podcasts. And I just think it's like it's like a super radio interview, right? It's like imagine if that cool interview on the radio that you listen to driving to the office could go on for another half an hour. Would you listen to that? And it just I like the conversations. Truth be told, it's easier than writing. It hurts my brain less than writing, definitely. Even though I'm an over-preparer and I over-prepare. And it lets, I don't know how important this is. People tell me it's important. It lets a different part of your personality shine through that will ever come out in your writing. And I've been told that's important.
Totally agree. And one of the things that's interesting to me is have you had to work on, or if nothing else, acknowledge being a personality on your podcast in addition to the formal role of questioner journalist, because there is an entertainment aspect to this medium. And was that a difficult or was that a challenge for you to have to show personality or to be quote unquote a personality as you were asking questions of well-known NBA people?
I think I'm probably still not enough of a personality. Like I think there are some people who probably find it boring. That said, I've part of it comes naturally, right? Like if you're talking to someone that you know about a subject that you both like, you're going to have a natural sort of lively back and forth. And I will say this, as you're doing this, as you know, there's lots of thoughts going through your head. There's jokes that come to mind.
Right.
There's lines that come to mind. And I tend to, when one of those things comes into my head and it's like on the edge of being, inappropriate is the wrong word. It's on the edge of being like too much entertainment for entertainment's sake rather than substantive. I err on the side of saying it just to see how it goes.
Zach, why was Bill Simmons a good boss to work for?
Is he? No, I'm just kidding. He was a good boss because, so you know, in this, he gave you the freedom to try things and explore creative, different sides of your creative process or whatever, and encouraged you to do that. And if something worked, great. If something didn't work, back to the drawing board. I'll say this in a very fundamental way. You've worked for a lot of places in this business, or you've been in this business a long time. I've worked for a lot of places in this business. Everyone is stressed out and harried. Is that harried? Like busy.
Right.
All the time. And that naturally leads to sort of
anxiousness,
right. But also just like you don't have time for the niceties.
Right.
I can't tell you how refreshing it was to get occasional emails and phone calls from him that would just say, hey, you did really well on that story. Hey, that's a great column. Great podcast today. That I just hadn't had a lot of that in my career. And then when it happened, it sounds so lame, but it felt good. It really felt good.
That's interesting you say that because Scott Price, who writes under SL Price here at SI, is a longtime good friend of mine. He always talks about how writers are so easy that if you just throw them some praise in an email, they'll do anything for you. And a great example of what
that's not what I mean. Like we're
but he's saying not that they're going to be in the tank for you. I'm talking about bosses acknowledging good work.
Yeah, any boss should do that.
They really want to then work for you. Peter King at MMQB is great about this. If somebody does a good story, he will just send an email. Hey, I can't thank you enough for writing this piece. I really liked it. That two-sentence thing means so much if you had other bosses, and I'm sure both of us have, who you never hear from after you've grinded 19-hour days.
Yep.
So it makes a big deal. All right, going back to Grantland, I know you're going to tread gingerly here about the dissolution of that site. But on an individual level, how heartbreaking was it for you that that site went away?
Heartbreaking is a little strong. I mean, this is a professional business world. I don't think getting your heart broken is generally a wise thing to do over almost anything. Like if something happened in my marriage, that would be heartbreaking, right? It was not. I mean, I am a person who in general craves security, right? So that's why I almost stayed at Sports Illustrated instead of jumping to what was then almost like a startup in Grantland, although one backed by the Disney Corporation. So for me, it was more like I had a place where I was confident it was going to last. I was confident my career was going to be okay. I liked my boss. I liked my colleagues. And when you get in a situation like that, if you're generally kind of an insecure, anxious personality, you don't want that taken away. And then it gets taken away and your whole world is kind of upside down. Like, what's going to happen to me? What's going to happen to the site? What's going to happen to my career? Who do I work for now? It was all of those kind of emotions. Yeah, I mean, it was you felt like you were part of something. And I still feel like I'm part of something. So it was sad. But, I mean, heartbreaking is like, this is the way of the world.
How did you personally feel when you found out that ESPN and Bill were parting ways? Is that when the sort of the anxiousness kicked in a little bit? Or did you,
sure.
Were you of the hope that, listen, you know, our site's founder and face is gone, but we could still figure out a way to make this work?
You know, it's funny. One of the benefits of being in my like New York silo, as you put it, is I didn't really know what was happening, right? So like I wasn't involved in any meetings. I didn't hear any gossip. I didn't know anything. So I was sitting in a hotel room in Washington. It broke in the morning, I believe, like around 9:30 in the morning.
On Twitter.
Well, and I was in D.C. covering the Wizards, writing a story about the Wizards during the playoffs. It was May, right?
Yep.
I think it was May.
Yep.
And I got my coffee, I got my breakfast, and I'm sitting down to a nice morning before they shoot around, and I don't know, who knows what I'm doing, transcribing. I got Twitter. I see Richard Sandomir, ESPN, ESPN will not renew Bill Simmons' contract. Holy crap. And I called Bill. Of course, you know, Bill's got 9,000 things going on. My phone goes crazy all day. You probably called me.
I think I direct messaged you.
It was more like, I remember I had a meeting scheduled for that day with an agent, a basketball agent.
Right.
And it was one of the, you know, those meetings where like you want to be present at the meeting, but you're not. Your head is swimming with thoughts. And my head was swimming with thoughts. It was not like, I'm not like crying, or I'm just more like I want to be on firm ground again. I want to know what's going to happen, and what you can't accept, what's hard to accept in those moments is you can't know for at least a little bit what's going to happen.
So what were those next couple of weeks and months like for you when Bill is gone and the site, Chris Connolly comes in and the site is trying to make a go, is trying to figure out what it is?
They were fine. I mean, honestly, it was the playoffs. I there was no time for wallowing or stressing or getting involved in whatever politics might have been going on. I really don't know. I'm being truthful.
I believe you.
I'm traveling around the NBA playoffs. I don't know what was going on. I just know the message to me was just continue to do what you're doing. So I just said, you know what? I'm going to put my head. I'm very good at putting my head down, staying out of stuff and doing what I'm doing. So it was okay. Honestly, it was okay. It was weird because everywhere I would go, people would ask me about it. And I say, I don't know. I'm fine, guys. I'm fine. I got a little baby. I'm fine. I'm doing good.
How did you find out that the site was being dissolved? That was just, it was going to stop.
I think it was pretty well publicized, right? That there was a statement that ESPN tweeted out.
Right.
Right. And that statement was read to us very shortly before it was tweeted out.
Did you get calls from whether it was Chris Connolly or somebody else sort of personally saying, we really appreciate what you've done, the site's closing, and we want you to stay at ESPN to do NBA writing?
I'm not going to go into who talked
okay.
to
me. All right. So how would you classify what you are doing now? Are you a ESPN NBA writer, or how do I?
I'm whatever my title says. Yeah, all my stuff appears on ESPN.com. Right. It's like I do the same stuff. It just lives in a different spot.
Right. And you are you happy with how the your assignments have been, the placement of your stuff, the collegiality of whoever you're working with and editors and stuff like that?
Yeah. I mean, honestly, the transition has been – almost nothing has changed, truthfully. Like,
that's
almost
great.
Nothing has changed. The transition – there's been little mechanical things here or there that have changed, but the transition has been great. People at ESPN have been great, like, supportive, and you know, it's been smooth.
This is the fun part of the interview where I know you're not going to answer this, but I'm just going to ask it just for fun.
Good.
It's not a secret that there are a number of outlets interested in your services. How flattering is that when you hear that there are other people and other groups out there that would love for you to be working for them?
You may know stuff that I don't know.
Right.
End of response.
All right. Where do you stand in terms of a long-term decision on where you want to write?
I'm happy writing at ESPN.
Okay. So as is it fair to say that as of the moment, you are a pleased and satisfied ESPN employee?
Yeah.
Okay. You don't want to say what your contractual status is in terms of heading forward, correct?
I think that would be inappropriate.
Okay. In everything, if everything was equal and you were a free agent being able to do whatever you want, would a place like The Ringer be of interest to you just in terms of what you think they might be?
No comment.
This is the fun part of the interview, Zach. All right, let's talk about television. I appreciate you even answering this question. I know you don't love that.
I can't answer.
No, I totally respect it. How much do you enjoy or not enjoy appearing on TV?
TV's fun.
Why is it fun?
It's funny. A lot of people probably get nervous on TV. I don't. I just think it's like even though I am an over-preparer, like I anally prepare for things.
Right.
You don't always have time for that. And one of the things I have to remind myself all the time is like, if I can't talk extemporaneously about the NBA in a smart way, like what the hell am I doing in life? I mean, this is all I do.
Right.
So I better be able to get up there.
But there's a real art to doing it in 45 seconds, right? If you have 45 seconds before, you have to go to Rachel on the jump or something like that.
That's part of why it's fun for me, because it's so different from what I do day to day. And I have to totally retrain my brain for that half hour. And I'm not saying I'm good at it, because I have, God knows I have a lot to learn, but I think I could be good at it.
How do you get, this is something I've talked to Simmons about. How do you get better on TV? Is it just a matter of reps? It's just reps. So it's knowing where to look,
yep,
how to get used to your IFB and stuff like that.
It's knowing where to look and knowing how to sit and knowing that you say like too much or whatever.
Oh, interesting.
And it's also knowing like you just said it perfectly. Like you got 45 seconds. It's a better feel. Like when I do, I just had Brett Brown on a podcast. We agreed on 45 minutes. I have a 45-minute clock in my head that's, like, perfect. I do not have a 45-second clock. So learning that clock and how much time I have. And honestly, like, sometimes if you're thinking about the show and you have a good one-liner and you think, I don't want to be one of those guys on TV who says one-liners. Like, one-liners work really well on TV. You should say them. They're really good.
Alan Kim knows I do not have a clock in my head. What advice would you give young people who want to be multimedia performers, who want to – not only do what you do digitally, but they want to be podcasters and they want to be on TV? Because you're someone who's you came to it late. You know?
I'm like the Minnesota Timberwolves. I fell ass backward into everything you just mentioned. So I guess my thing is like, just like, you cannot do anything unless you do it. Right. And that sounds like a stupid thing to say, but like, you can fret about, how am I going to get this job interview? How am I going to get this opportunity? Blah, blah, blah. But we also live in a world now where you can make that opportunity. So if you want to write about the NBA and you can't find anyone who will let you write about the NBA, just write on your own. And like, just if it's good, people will notice it.
All right, here's the final third of our podcast.
Yeah,
you do this at the clock in my head. You do Q&As with people around the league. How do you form your questions? You obviously are a deep reader, so that you know, reading to you is important to process that. But do you have a specific way as to, do you write questions down, let's say, like before you?
Yeah, I do.
Okay.
Or at the very least, sort of broad, like shorthand notes that remind me what to ask. It's a mix of what basketball questions can I ask them that maybe they haven't been asked in this kind of venue about. Like, so, you know, I literally just had Brett Brown, which is why it's in my head, but I wanted to ask him about playing Julius Okafor at power forward or having him guard power forwards. Like, let's get a good answer on that. Part of it is doing as much background reading as you can, as you have time for. So like, what's an interesting nugget in their life that you could ask about, or what have they been asked about too many times? So it's not worth it unless you have another spin on it.
How many games a week are you covering right now in person?
Not that many.
Yeah. Is it because of the baby or just because you're in a pattern now where you're doing other things?
Well, the Knicks and the Nets have both been on the road for like a weird long period of time. And I was just somewhere. I was in Boston and I was in Toronto and LA. So
And you were at the All-Star game, so you kind of travel, right?
Yeah. Not games. Not that many. Like I will sometimes go to a game and hang around for the first half and then leave if I have no reason to and then watch another game on DVR. Games are like, until the playoffs, games are a networking exercise for me more than anything else.
All right, one more for me, and then I'm going to get to questions that people submitted on Twitter, and there were a ton. I could not even get through them. There were so many.
Sad.
Yeah, people are interested, Zach. When I did research about your career, there were a number of Stanford Advocate stories that came up. And one of the things that was interesting to me is you did cover crime there. And so I just happened to read a story, and it's really essentially like a 600-word kind of newser about a pastor in Bridgeport facing sexual assault charges after a 14-year-old member of his congregation accused him of raping her twice.
I literally have no memory of that.
Okay.
That's amazing.
Yeah. What I wanted to sort of get into using that was, does crime story sort of stay with you? And is there anything from that world that you use in today's NBA reporting? Or maybe there's not.
No, there is. I mean, those are very uncomfortable subjects, right? And you're covering people in the worst or most stressful moments of their life.
Right.
So there are a couple of things that come to mind. Number one is, like, I've said this before, but like Greg Popovich is not scary. If you've covered murders and drug dealers and gang members and literally or, you know, if you've had to go ask a mother about her dead daughter or something, like, those are bad situations. These basketballs, none of this is bad. The other thing is, when you write a crime story, and this is useful when I do some, let's say, harder reporting about it, the inner workings of teams, is it's kind of like when everyone on all sides is pissed off at you, you've probably got it right.
Yeah.
And you just have to deal with people being pissed off at you. That and to not panic when everyone's pissed off at you.
You know, I would sort of say you have you call it a beat in loose terms. You're a national NBA writer. But when you were working at the Stanford Advocate, you had a real beat. Did you enjoy that, marinating in really something very specific?
Loved it. Yeah. If you could make any money covering local crime, I would cover local crime. Local crime is so much fun.
Interesting.
And also the thing, like, so this, I did a podcast with Scott Brooks last week at Sloan, and I saw one of my best guys that I follow on Twitter, this guy Nate Jones, who's an agent and a lawyer,
yeah, right,
said, good for Zach Lowe. You know, he's really criticized Scott Brooks a lot, and he had the guts to have Scott Brooks on his podcast. I'm like, that's not guts. That's like how you do journalism.
Exactly.
Like,
right.
You wrote this nasty thing about this cop or this lawyer or this police chief or whatever. And like, yeah, you got to go next day. You face him. That's what it is.
Is that Nate Jones, NBA? Handle?
Yeah,
he's good. I like that guy.
Very sharp dude.
No, not surprising at all. All right. Here, we'll finish up with some questions that you guys asked from Twitter. I should have done a better job of getting everybody's handle here, but you'll know who it is when I read the question. You answered this. What's the transition been like from Grantland to ESPN? Is there anything different between the two? But for you, it's basically been the same thing, right?
Basically nothing, yeah.
Okay. What is better or more interesting for you, the NBA Summer League or the Sloan Conference?
I guess Summer League? They're more interesting because they are events where the entire NBA world is, and that makes them exciting. I'd probably say Summer League is better.
Has any player aggressively approached you after you wrote something negative? And if so, what happened?
Aggressively?
Or maybe we forget about aggressively. We'll just make it approached. You have opinion-based pieces, and are there any players or coaches who've come up to you and expressed disagreement
yes.
off?
Yes.
You want to relay that story or no?
Nothing. Honestly, there's nothing. I'm trying to. I would be happy to relay it if I could think of one. Coach, there's got to be a coach who came at me.
And did it probably revolve around you questioning strategy or something like that?
No. Sometimes yes, and sometimes it's, you know, sometimes you write something snarky because it's snarky and it's going to be funny and they don't like that.
Right.
It's happened before with coaches and a couple of players, but nothing like ugly. No ugly blowups.
Sarita's calling you respected basketball mind. So since you are a respected basketball mind, would you ever consider a front office position like John Hollinger?
Who's to say I haven't?
Well, that's interesting. Have you?
I don't know. I'm not going to say. Whatever opportunity is interesting,
right,
I'll consider it. But to me, the thing there are two things that I've talked to Hollinger about this before. Working in the NBA is so funny because it's like, not funny, but the two things that would worry me would be, one, the travel, right? I just am not interested in traveling the earth to scout basketball players and alienate my family. And B, like, it's just so weird that when your boss is fired, you're fired. Everyone's just fired in the NBA. Like, that doesn't happen in a lot of industries where, like, the GM's fired. So, like, if you work for R.C. Buford, who's never going to be fired, you're probably okay. If you work for Billy King, you have a pretty good chance that you're about or have been or about to be fired. And that's just that kind of lack of – like, rarely does an industry make journalism job security look good, right? I mean
– that's it. You know, it's – is there ever a part of you that, like, do you feel like – writing about something or commenting about something, you're always at a distance from what it really is. And Hollinger sort of, if nothing else, is like, he's in there, he's doing it. So that must be in a way, compelling or interesting for you to, rather than to write about this as a sort of a distance observer, to actually be in the middle of it, maybe having an impact on the sport you used to cover.
A GM told me not long ago, "Oh, Zach, you don't really know what it's like because you haven't worked for a team." I'm like, yeah, no kidding. I haven't worked for a team. Believe me, you think I'm an idiot? Like, I know I haven't worked for a team. And so, like, there are internal pressures that I probably either underestimate. I mean, I do my best to ask people about them and be understanding of them, but I'm never going to know what it's like to work for owner X or what it's like to have to consider the business side of a transaction or every single trade idea that was pitched or rejected. It's that's just the way it is.
And again, we're all talking hypothetical, but given your journalistic background, would it be tough to sort of, I don't know if objectivity even sort of exists, but would it be tough to align yourself with a singular group as opposed to the position you're in now where you do have some flexibility in terms of objectivity?
I don't think so, because everything's different, right? Everything has its benefits and its drawbacks. So, like, if you go to work for a team and you can talk to Hollinger about this, you can't follow every other team.
Right.
So you lose some of that. But on the flip side, it's like you get to root again. You get to cheer again. You get to feel like the agony and the excitement. And I don't feel that anymore. So that's kind of fun too.
Yeah, there's a lot of coaches who famously say they miss the agony, right? When they're out of.
I don't understand why any coach ever goes back to coaching. Every coach that gets fired in the NBA, A, they have like a year left to just get money.
Right.
And B, like they all lose weight and
they
sleep
look great.
More
Van Gundy.
And get healthier.
Well,
it's
you
like,
talked to Tibbs. How does Tibbs look right now? You talked to him.
Tibbs looks good. Tibbs looks happy. Tibbs looks happy.
He's going to go back.
Of
you know
course
that.
He's going to go back.
They all go back. How much or how little do you enjoy Twitter?
Twitter has probably overall been a net negative in my life.
Wow, that's interesting. Why is that?
Partly it's my fault that I can't resist looking at all the nasty things that people say about me. But for me, it's like I think Twitter's amazing. I think it's a great reading service, right? Like it's like having every local beat reporter zoomed right into your brain. But I just remember during the lockout being at a party on a Saturday night and with my wife and a bunch of friends and just being on my phone the whole time. And that was must have been 2011, I guess. This is early-ish Twitter, although I guess not that early. Didn't Twitter just celebrate its 10th anniversary or something crazy?
Yeah.
And I just remember that was the party where I thought, I've become that guy. I've become the guy whose job is running his life. And it's because of this service where it's great that I can know the second something happens, but it's also like that makes me check it every second, and that's probably bad.
Yeah, it's interesting. It's like among the greatest and worst inventions that I've ever been personally a part of for the exact reasons, because it really can consume you for the bad, but yet as a distribution news source, I've never seen anything better.
You know what's been good for that? Having a kid.
Yeah, I agree. I check it much less, although, yeah, my own family, wife would say I should check it much, much less. All right, two more. What apps or websites does Zach Lowe use to track scores and stats on his phone?
I am the most technologically behind 38-year-old journalist you will have. Like, I don't have Uber. So I have no app that I use, like, the Chrome app to check scores. I have no app. I have no nothing. I have whatever apps my phone came with, plus Twitter.
All right, final two. What is the process that you use for finding and selecting GIFs for your weekly column? GIFs or video or whatever.
So let's say I'm – what did I write recently? I don't know. Let's say I'm writing about the Hornets.
Okay.
And I want to write about the Hornets offense. I'll just spend a day watching film of the Hornets offense, or I'll look at, sometimes it's film, sometimes it's numbers. And if you're, you notice that they run the same play over and over again, or this guy's shooting gravity helps create spacing for Al Jefferson or whatever it may be. You just sort of watch clips until you find like the best examples of that or the fitting examples. It's no, there's no, and then I email someone at ESPN saying, here are the clips I'd like, and they appear.
And they appear. Okay. Is there anything we have not covered before I get to the last question? Is there anything is there something on your mind?
What is the last question going to be?
It's not even that great a question. Is there a subject matter that you want to go down? We've covered Grantland. You don't want to go into the ringer or your own contractual.
It was a lot more Grantland than I thought.
I appreciate
it was
that. Same here. I didn't think you would go into that. We talked about basketball. I could have asked you, like, are there guys in the league you really love to talk to? But my sense is that there's probably 100 guys you love to
talk to. Yeah, and it would be the same old answers that, you know, I always give.
All right, so my final question then is, how do you relax when you are away from basketball? What do you do?
Can you relax? As you know, there's very little time for that. You know what would be the best thing is if I was one of those people that found cooking relaxing. Because cooking you're serving a purpose for the household. Like, you can cook for your kid, right. You can cook for your family. I suck at cooking, so I just find it a stressful time suck. So that's not it. Really how I like to relax is now, what I used to like to relax by going out to dinners and drinks with all my friends. That happens less often,
right?
Almost never. So now it's more like I need a TV show and I need to shut my brain off. I have one episode left in Mr. Robot.
You watch The Americans at all?
No, it's been recommended to me. I can only handle like one at a time.
All right.
It's been recommended to me. You know what I regret? Every summer I used to pick a show that I was behind on and just binge it when the NBA was not going on. So a few summers ago, that was Breaking Bad. Great decision. A couple summers later, it was Game of Thrones, which I punted on. I hit eject halfway
through.
Tough punt.
It's great. It's great.
Didn't do it for me. I punted something else too recently. You know what else I ejected from? House of Cards. House of Cards is stupid.
It faded on me a little bit, which was very depressing because I loved that first season, which was unbelievable.
The second season, by the time I ejected after season two. When he becomes president, you're like, what just happened? None of this makes any sense. It's a show that wants to be prestigious and realistic that is completely off the wall, insane, and makes no sense. Mr. Robot's been fun. I have high hopes for the final episode. Do not say anything to me further about that.
I could not tell you anything about Mr. Robot. All right, before we go, Alan Kim, is there anything that you want to add? Because I know Alan is a...
I didn't know Alan. This is a wild card.
Alan is a fervent NBA reader, producer.
You are now going rogue. I did not know this was part of the podcast.
Nor did I. Alan, is there anything, Zach? You had questions for Zach, if I remember.
Well, I have a lot of questions, but for the sake of time, I'll just keep it to this one. So you had Bob Myers recently on the podcast, and you were talking about the coach, GM, owner.
Yeah, the fake 3-on-3 tournament.
Right. So I was curious which teams rounded out the top five. I believe you had the Hornets at number one and the Warriors at number two.
Warriors, if healthy, would be number one.
Okay.
Because I think Kerr and Myers could at least contain Jordan.
Really?
They could double Jordan.
Ooh.
There were not that many good teams because there was always one weak link that was so abysmal.
Yeah.
I honestly don't even think we got very far in constructing a real powerhouse challenge to those two.
For my friends in Toronto, you give them any chance of beating the Cavs in the postseason?
You're going to ask me basketball questions now?
This is the last thing, just because we're just about to wrap up.
You have friends in Toronto?
I do. A lot of them. Yeah. It's a great town, as you know. It was very cold when you went, but it's
I love Toronto. I didn't mind that it was cold. People need to stop whining about that. Toronto is an awesome all-star city. Awesome.
I agree.
I would be shocked if they beat the Cavs.
Yeah, same here. It's a bummer.
Can I ask you a question?
Of course.
Is this appearance going to get me on any of your best lists ever?
You not appearing on a weekly best list or
anything.
Like the end of the year?
Anything. I've never gotten anything.
I can't believe that because you've done. I've praised you and done such great work, and I've certainly praised you on Twitter, and I definitely have linked your stuff.
The only
on
reason
Twitter.
I did this podcast. I'm just kidding.
I will. First of all, I'm flattered that you even want to be on the list. Yeah, we'll see what we can do down the road. I'm gonna pay more attention to you write a lot. It'd be linking a lot of things.
I write less now than
you
I
do.
Used to.
All right, the guest has been Zach Lowe, who has a far more popular podcast than this one that we didn't mention. That was it's called The Low Post.
The Low Post.
Right. It's called The Low Post. Zach, of course, you can read his work on ESPN.com And his resume needs no introduction or reintroduction, but I'll give it anyway. Grantland, Sports Illustrated, Stanford Advocate, ESPN.com.
American Lawyer.
American Lawyer, the True Hoop Network. I encourage you to listen to Zach's podcast. It's excellent. I mean, I love the NBA. I'm certainly nowhere near as schooled on it as Zach is, and I find those interviews really interesting. I think he does a great job there. Zach, it took forever to get you. I mean,
yeah, I'm sorry.
I pursued you for like 9 months, but you have come to our building, and I appreciate it.
I wanted one thing. I did want to do it in person. I didn't know that would make you uncomfortable.
It makes me a little uncomfortable, but it's okay.
I got through it. Somehow. I thought it would be the best case scenario for you.
No, I'd much rather do it on phone. But anyway, Zach, you've come to beautiful downtown Manhattan. We appreciate it. Zach Lowe has been the guest on the SI Media podcast. Rather than me and Alan wrapping up, I'll just wrap up here and say Hubie Brown will be the next guest.
Wow.
Yeah, he's coming up.
Seriously?
Yeah, later in the week, which will be great.
Oh, my God.
And other guests will be Kara Lawson is coming up. So yet another. We're
Boo,
doing a lot of
Tennessee.
Yeah, we're doing a lot of basketball. Ken Burns, the documentary filmmaker. And I believe we're going to get Renee Young, the WWE broadcaster. So we have a ton, like, it's a very good potpourri. But Zach Lowe starts off the basketball part of the SI Media podcast. My thanks to Alan, Kim, Bette Marston, both excellent producers. Thank you to executive producer Dan Bloom, Ryan Hunt, and Paul Fichtenbaum for the support. This is Richard Deitch. See you again on the Sports Illustrated Media podcast.
Do you know about the Locked On Podcast Network, the number one daily sports podcast network? Locked On has a daily podcast on every NBA and NFL team, plus a growing lineup of college and MLB teams. You get a daily bite-sized podcast giving you the latest on your team from the local experts. Lakers fans, search Locked On Lakers. Cowboys fans, search Locked On Cowboys. Just search Locked On, your favorite team, on Apple Podcasts or Google Podcasts, or tell your smart speaker to play podcast Locked On, your favorite team. Locked On Podcast Network, your team every day.